Okay, the date is the 8th of May 2018, and the location for this oral history is the Lillian Martin Aged Care Home in Mornington. My name's Philip Hoisted. I'm interviewing Mr. Greg Properjohn. Greg, better known throughout a very long and illustrious career as Alf Properjohn, in jazz circles is one of the most well-regarded and influential jazz drummers to grace the Tasmanian musical scene. The interview will be structured along the following lines. Greg's own personal history, growing up in Tasmania, and about his family and how he initially got into jazz. We'll then move on to, secondly, the jazz scene itself in Tasmania and to a lesser extent Australia. Throughout the 1950s, 60s and 70s, and how jazz in Tasmania is different from the rest of the world, and who were some of the most influential players. But it's fairly flexible, Greg. I'll be asking you questions. You can answer them any way you like. And I think the best place to start is to say, okay, what's your earliest memory going back to childhood?
Well, I was born in Western Australia, the third of three brothers.
Three, yeah.
In 1949. My earliest memory was of a beautiful climate, feel, for a start.
Yeah.
Never seemed to be winter in Perth.
Well, I've been over there, it's been too bloody hot, so...
Yes, well, that could be a fair call. However, I went to a little school for only a year or so, and my father, who was an air traffic controller, applied for a job on the Cocos Islands as the administrator, and we went there for 2 years. Now you'll notice.
Do you remember what age you were roughly when you went to the Cocos Islands?
Oh, 3 or 4. About ready to start school.
You remember the crabs? Remember the crabs on Cocos Island?
I remember the crabs on Cocos Island very, very well. One steered clear thereof. but it was an interesting education because there was one little school room. And kids from beginners to grade 6, all in the one classroom, and an absolutely wonderful teacher who managed somehow to deal with the whole situation. However, music hadn't entered into the scenario at this time.
Yeah,
and we came back to. Western Australia, where my father resumed his position, and the hit parades started, you know, in the mid to late 50s.
So let me get this right. You came back from the Cocos Islands, back to Perth?
Yes, back to Perth.
And you would have been, what, 5 or 6 when you came back? Or?
6 or 7, I think, Phil.
Yep, okay.
Went to a horrid little primary school.
Why was it horrid?
Run by nuns who'd been trained by the Nazis.
I see.
But I remember I got into trouble on my first day there, which was some sort of a record.
Do you remember what you did?
I chased a ball and I was supposed to be sitting down and having my lunch.
Oh, a hideous crime.
Yes, dangerous, I tell you. But I started to listen to the radio, but it certainly wasn't jazz. Mm. It was after the end of the swing era, but Perth being rather an isolated place, you'd still hear the big band programs occasionally.
Did you? I'd be
interested in those.
So let me clarify. So it was the radio that initially got you interested.
Yes,
in the
music. It was radio.
So,
yes.
Like the typical family, you'd be sitting around the radio. Do you have a TV in those days?
No TV at that stage of the game in Australia.
Okay.
No.
Yep.
Now, in the late 50s, Phil, and I can't give you a precise time, but in the late 50s, Dad applied for and received the job of manager of the new Hobart Airport. Now, it had just been built. Prior to that, it was the little one across the road. This was the new Hobart Airport. And so we moved to Tasmania.
Yep.
And I went to a school called St. Virgil's, and it didn't have a music program.
Oh, okay.
Very poor. However, oh, and this was out in Austin's Ferry, Phil. This was a brand new school. We were the first kids there in first year high school.
Is that when the school opened, basically?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
However, we were all moved back into the city, I think in second year high school. And there was a cadet corps. Now, the cadet corps was a kind of a funny deal because we discovered many years later that the school got X pennies probably per child who was a cadet.
You also got out of going to school though, didn't you, as well?
This was after school.
Oh, after school.
Much.
I apologise for the outrage.
So everybody became a cadet or did a couple of hours of mathematics. So needless to say,
I think they call that Hobson's choice.
Yes. Needless to say, we became cadets. Then they decided to form a drum and bugle corps, which was a grand idea, except that they didn't have any instruments or anybody to teach them.
Yep.
So the army finally came up with a collection of marching drums, Phil.
Yeah.
And this might sound difficult to believe, but I've only seen photos or drawings of drums like this before. They were, I am positive, pre-World War I. They were rope tensioned.
Okay. Yeah.
Those that have seen old photos of colonial drummers, the skins were tightened by pulling down on ropes.
Okay.
That was situated around the drum kit. So in actual fact, the snare drums, which is always the sharp one in the drum kit, that's supposed to be the marching drum. That sounded like a tom-tom. So, but we learned to live with that, and we saw photos of how to hold the drumsticks. Now,
hang on, before you go on, who's we? Are you talking about just yourself?
Myself and the other blokes, the other four or five blokes who were in the drum corps. How the buglers got on, I don't know. We looked at photographs and we adopted what is now known as the traditional grip.
Okay.
It's a little difficult to describe over a disc, but today the majority of players hold their drumsticks the same way in each hand.
Did you hold them like this?
Yes. Back in those days, one drumstick was on an angle.
Yep.
And the reason for that was quite simple and went back about 600 years. Drums were all marching drums and slung over the shoulder, and it wasn't possible to play with both hands matched. And so they figured out this, what we call traditional grip. And so that's how we started to try and teach ourselves.
Now, hang on, before you go on, the big question is, why drums? Why didn't you join the brass band section, the trumpet section? Why did you decide to go for drums?
The easy answer to that, I suppose, is that all little boys want to play the drum. But I can't really describe to you, there was something deeper inside me that wanted to do it. You know, maybe I'd been influenced by what I'd heard on the radio, maybe I'd been influenced by a photograph. There certainly wasn't a great deal to stimulate one in those days, not like today. But I just decided on the drum, and that was that.
It's interesting you said you felt it deep inside. Did you know of any drummers or famous drummers you wanted to emulate at that age?
Not really. I suppose I would have heard of, as most people in those days would have done, probably would have heard of Gene Krupa, who was a very, very famous big band drummer.
Yeah.
And a fellow called Buddy Rich, who many considered to be the greatest drummer that ever lived.
Yeah.
And also one of the nastiest men that ever lived too. Which he managed to wear two hats, Buddy, yeah.
Was he Australian or?
He was American.
Oh, okay.
Very American. we were, he, there's a very interesting story about Buddy. His big band was booked to play at the City Hall, and for some reason there wasn't a large number of people wanted to go.
Yep.
And the casino picked him up. And so we all trotted along to the casino at midnight, which back in those days, you know, I can't give you a date, but, you know, it was pretty early 60s.
Yeah.
Was pretty remarkable, you know, a midnight show. But the glorious part about it was that in the early hours of the morning, Buddy got busted by the drug squad. And
this in Hobart.
In Hobart. And this was a very big deal indeed. Needless to say, all he did was hop on the next plane and disappear.
Never to be seen again.
No, he was seen again. He was seen the next night in Melbourne, and he spoke for about 30 minutes about Hobart on stage. Not very politely.
When he was busted, was he dragged off the stage or...?
No, he was in his hotel room having a quiet joint and doubtless thinking what a terrible place he was stuck in. And he got a knock on the door. He was the first fellow that I saw that was a tremendous influence on me. His technique was phenomenal, and I think it's important for people to realise that perhaps of all of the instruments, for a drummer to actually watch another drummer is an excellent way to learn.
Is it?
Yes.
What, more so than other instruments? Or?
I think so, yes. I'm not sure about guitar players, but drummers, you know, you're watching their hands, and if you're lucky somehow, you're watching their feet or you're listening to their feet.
Okay.
Because you have to... you have to develop independence, or you're sort of stuck. And especially to play jazz, which we'll talk about later on.
Okay.
I became a pretty proficient rock and roll player, but that was back in the early days, and believe me, it wasn't difficult. It was not difficult at all.
Yeah. I'll save that question for later. Can we just hold it? You know, at the fact that you've gone to St. Virgil's, you've joined the cadets, you've got interested in drumming. We'll just keep that in your mind. But I'd like to go back to say, because it'll get lost if we don't do it. Let's talk a bit about your father and your mother and your brothers. So your father, he came down here to build the
airport.
Down.
Yes, he
a
came.
A bit of a character, wasn't he?
He was ex-RAAF.
Yeah.
And when he left the RAAF, he became an air traffic controller.
He fought in the Second World War, did he?
Yes, he was a supply dropper in New Guinea.
Okay.
That was how he put in his time. He survived an aeroplane crash. They crashed into the ocean. A very funny story about that. They'd invited a gentleman to dinner when we were on the Cocos Islands, and they sat down and the fellow said, "You know, Norman, the last time I heard your voice was saying, gentlemen, we appear to have a certain, now let me get this right, Phil, gentlemen, we seem to be in a certain amount of trouble."
As they ditched into the ocean.
At that stage, they were plummeting towards the ocean, yes. I think it was the Indian Ocean, but don't quote me.
He obviously landed okay.
Yes, yes, they were rescued. He went back to dropping supplies. He was of the opinion that they're probably still looking for some of the supplies that the boys pushed out, but that's another story. I had two brothers, Russell, who's 8 years older than me. He's now retired and lives in Canberra.
Yeah.
He spent his life as a diplomat overseas. My brother Terry has passed away now. He had an interesting life in that he was called up in the first intake of national service
for the
army.
For Vietnam or?
Well, what happened was he was a bit of a tearaway when he was a young fella, but it must have fitted into the army okay, because they decided to do this PR stunt, and they got a handful of chaps and they sent them to a place called Holdsworthy after they'd only been in the army for 6 or 8 weeks. Hmm. And they gave them a crash course and they came out as second lieutenants. And he found life a lot easier giving orders rather than taking them. And so he ended up signing up and he was a full-time soldier and retired as a colonel.
Did you go to the Vietnam War?
He served 3 times in Vietnam. Phil, there's very few conflicts that he didn't get involved in, actually. There was the Barney between the up in New Guinea, between the north and the south of New Guinea. There was a war in Burma. Wherever the Australians got themselves stuck with their noses stuck in, he was there, yeah.
Now, did any of your brothers have any interest in music as well?
No, none whatsoever. They listened, to rock and roll and so forth. But no, I was the only one with any interest in playing an instrument.
It's interesting, like, one becomes a diplomat, one becomes a soldier, and one becomes a jazz drummer.
Yeah.
What about your mother or father? Did they have a particular interest in music? Or?
Mum told me that she learnt the piano as a girl.
Yeah.
But her family split up when she was about 12 and the piano lessons stopped. And so I don't know for how many years. Dad's proud boast was that he knew 2 songs. One was the national anthem and the other one wasn't. So, although he...
Deeply patriotic man, obviously.
He was accused of boasting once that he sang Mona Lisa while he was doing his first solo flight. But it was pointed out quietly to others that when he was doing his first solo flight, Mona Lisa hadn't been written. So that story sort of fell on its bottom a bit. I do recall occasionally going out with him to his work.
Yeah.
And thinking back now on when you go to a air control office, it's just incredible technology, yeah. Panels and
yep.
just anything you can possibly imagine, like one would see on the television.
Very responsible job, though. I mean, for
and
guys.
Back in those days, he had a microphone and a speaker.
What, he shouted at the aeroplanes?
Basically, the only rule, it seemed, was that every pilot had to be able to speak English. And according to Dad, some of the pilots didn't speak English terribly well either, which made life difficult. He did not like being a traffic controller very much and so was overjoyed when he was given the job of airport manager in Hobart, because it wasn't a difficult job. There were two flights in the morning and two flights in the afternoon in those days.
Yep.
You know, as opposed to now when it's absolutely crazy.
Didn't you have to build the airport as well?
No, it was built.
Oh, it was built.
It had been built, yeah.
Now, you told me a story at some stage about how he got the job, and which was quite funny, but I can't remember what the circumstances were.
Well, I don't remember. I don't remember either. I can only imagine it. You know, it came up through the circle of blokes.
Yeah.
And X number put their hands up and.
It might be something about the golf course. Like, wasn't he asked to I'll build the airport, or I'll manage it as long as you build a golf course or something like that.
What happened? It was quite a funny story, and worth repeating.
Yeah.
We came down here, and we lived for, I think it must have been nearly a month in the Freemasons Hotel, whilst they were looking for somewhere to live, and we finally found a little house, and we stayed there, and they finally bought a house in Gilston Bay,
yep.
And it was only three or four houses up from the golf course.
Right.
Now, he'd never played golf in his life, but he thought, seeing as it had a bar and so forth, he might as well have a go, so he bought some golf clubs and became a golfer. Now, there was a great big tract of land on the airport that wasn't being used for anything.
Yeah.
So he thought it might be a good idea if they built a nine-hole golf course. Which he did,
yep.
By employing, he was a very shrewd employer, employing blokes to do jobs at the airport that were also skilled at doing other jobs,
yep.
Like building golf courses. And the golf course is still there. I don't know whether it's private or public these days.
I think you can go there and play. Laherne, you're talking about, aren't you there?
I do know, and we found out after his death that he occasionally toddled across to Laherne, which was the old airport, which was then a flying club.
Nice.
And hopped into an aeroplane and went for a bit of a spin. Nobody told anybody about that. We only found out about that after he died, because if he had been caught, they would have murdered him.
Oh, okay.
He would not have been very popular at all. Mum was just, she was a lovely lady, of course, and I loved her very much. She was very much a stay-at-home person. Dad taught her to tried to teach her to drive at one stage of the game, and that was a raging unsuccess. So she gave that away after a few efforts.
So they had a good marriage, didn't
they? They had a good marriage, yeah. Yes. Married for, must have been married for nearly 60 years, I reckon.
God, that's a long time.
It's a good long time, yeah. He didn't do much when he retired. I can't remember him doing much when he retired, apart from playing golf. They did buy
on his golf course.
They did buy themselves. He was actually a member and played most of his time at what was the Gilston Bay Golf, Lindisfarne Golf Club,
okay.
Which is now the Gilston Bay High School.
All right. Yeah.
But he did take ill with cancer. They had purchased a unit in Lindisfarne, a two-bedroom unit, and he took ill with cancer and lung cancer. He had been a heavy smoker.
Yeah.
Not prior to going into the service, but like so many blokes, he started to smoke in the service because part of their rations was a packet of cigarettes. So I moved back in and looked after him until he passed away.
How old was he?
I then moved out again, and then Mum developed bowel cancer, and so I moved back in again and looked after her.
You're a good, dutiful son.
I had a, well, I seemed to spend so much time looking after family. It's not funny. I moved down to Huonville in the 80s for 2 years to look after brother Terry, my middle brother,
yes,
who had separated but not divorced from his dear wife. And he came down here to attend the boat building. There's a wooden boat building course down in Huonville Way.
Yeah, down at Franklin.
Yeah, down at Franklin. And he came down here to do that. And he had a stroke. Oh. And so that took care of that. And he was in a pretty bad way. So the RSL fixed him up with a two-bedroom unit. And I went down and looked after him for a couple of years. And that was a pretty full-time job. Because he gave up.
Yeah.
When he first had his stroke, you know, he was exercising and doing this and doing that and really trying to get well. And all of a sudden he just packed it in and gave up. I'll never forget, because it is amusing now. He called me in one day and he said, I want a gin and tonic and an ambulance. And I said, you've never had a gin and tonic in your life. And he said, well, I want one now. Go and buy a bottle of gin and go and buy a bottle of tonic and go and call an ambulance. He was famous. He had trips to hospital and he was famous amongst the ambulance fraternity.
Yeah.
For being Colonel Proper John, because once he got inside the ambulance, he'd start issuing orders. but this time, unfortunately, the stroke took him in, and he didn't make it.
Did he have his gin and tonic?
He had his gin and tonic. Oh, excellent. He had that. Yep. He was content I said he'd given up, and he had, but he was content in his life. We were happy together.
Fair enough.
You know, I went up to town one day a week, and just made sure that he was looked after. And we had a local taxi driver who was an absolute saint, and he'd stick his head in every now and again and make sure everything was okay, you know. So that's pretty much family for you, Phil.
You were, is that what I'm asking? You never got married yourself?
No, I didn't.
No? No? No children or anything?
No, no children.
Devoted to the music, were you?
Yeah. Oh, I had my my lady friends, of course, but I didn't marry. And children, well, I spent so many years teaching that I had an extended family, if you like. hundreds of them, you know, that I still occasionally hear from one or two, which is nice.
We'll get on to that later. So you'd say you have a happy childhood?
Yes.
And what sort of child were you like?
It was happy, but I was unhappy at school.
Okay.
I disliked school because it was the Christian Brothers, in inverted commas, and corporal punishment was the order of the day.
Right.
And it was for doing things that today you'd get your shot, you know, like getting sums wrong or spelling something wrong.
And what would they do, like, for example?
That. When they were in their training, they made their own straps. Mm-hmm. Which was a piece of leather about a quarter of an inch thick with a steel, a wire down the middle, and then another quarter of an inch thick piece of leather. And these two stuck together, and when they hit you with that, mate, you knew you'd been hit.
So where would they hit you? On the hand or bum or what?
On the hand mainly. And if they were feeling particularly creative, just above the hand, right on the where your hand joins your arm.
And this would happen daily or weekly?
This would happen daily. Oh, yeah. And I I set quite a record, actually, because 2 or 3 days a week I would walk from Austin's Ferry to Geilston Bay. I'd get off the we used to catch the train out there. I'd get off the train at school and I'd walk from Austin's Ferry to Geilston Bay. To this day, I'm still staggered that any human being could walk that far and still survive, but I did. I didn't like school very much. I had to repeat grade 10 because I didn't get the requisite number of points. And so I was very happy to see the end of education. And
when did you actually leave? At the end of year 10? Or?
At the end of year, I think it was 1965, Phil.
Was it?
Yes, I think it was 1965 because I think I went to work. I didn't have many jobs apart from music, but I did go to work in 1966. Like most boys of my age, I joined the public service, the taxation department.
Did you?
The number of blokes who joined the public service that I went to school with was quite staggering. I don't know how they managed to accommodate them all. I really don't. I didn't last there terribly long. I was sort of, I resigned before I was sacked because I didn't do any work. I was put under the tutelage of a local drummer, Terry Tuttle. Now, we both know...
Who was in the tax office as
well. He was in the tax office as well. And they sat me down and said, righto, this is Greg Cropper, John, and show him how to do your job and then we'll move you on to another job. Terry's wife was... It's a typical Tasmanian situation. Terry's wife was my father's secretary.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yep.
Little old tiny Tassie.
It is.
But anyway, Terry and I talked about drums all day, you know, and I didn't know much about the job at all. So,
was he a jazz drummer or?
No, not really. But most, apart from some of the younger blokes at that stage of the game, most of the drummers were still what we would call swing-based drummers. Okay. In other words, they played the swing style in the cabarets, you know, where they did old-fashioned dancing, you know. The rock and roll scene was entirely different. And I played rock as well.
Did you?
Yes, I did that. And at one stage during the 60s, and I can't give you dates, there are three different dances in Hobart, and it was quite remarkable that the Metropolitan Transport Trust put on extra buses to bus kids to and from these places. There was one in Sandy Bay, one in North Hobart, and one in South Hobart, and just in football club rooms, you know, this sort of thing. And yes, the bands ran their own. Oh, except for one bloke who was an entrepreneur, the bands ran their own shows, you know, and did very well indeed. Although it was not unusual for a number to cease halfway through whilst the band descended from the bandstand, broke up a fight, climbed back on the bandstand and started the song again.
You talking about rock and roll here, or
yes.
You talking about jazz?
Oh, no. The jazz scene has always been, it had some violence in Sydney. There were a few blokes who were petty crims, you know, they supplemented their income in various ways, but as a general thing, Phil, no, the jazz crowd was there for the music, and that's just the way it was. Yes.
Okay, don't let me forget. We'll get back to the rock and roll stuff. in the early days. But can we now go back to, well, unless there's anything else you want to say about your family?
No, that's all.
No, sure. Go back to St. Virgil's College and the cadets. You decided to do drumming. You felt like it was something that was inside you. And so how did you get involved with the cadets, and how did you become the drummer and not someone else? And how did that sort of lead to the next stage of your career?
Well, first of all, you became a cadet. That was the end of the argument, you know, unless you wanted to do mathematics for 2 hours. So you became a cadet, and they issued you with a uniform.
Yeah.
And they had a parade every Friday afternoon. I think it was from 3 to 4:30 or something like that.
Yeah.
And who came up with the idea of having the drum and bugle corps, I don't know. I've no idea.
So what did you actually do? What did that corps do?
We basically played for marching.
Okay, so...
Yeah.
Right, so you were out there with your drums and all the other cadets were there and you're playing the drums and they're all marching up and down?
That's right, yeah. That's,
really?
Yeah. Okay, yeah, that's right. Basically how it worked.
And how did you know at that stage you were good at the drums? You know, were you good at it from the word go, or did it take time?
It took time. But I did, if I do say so myself, I did have a natural aptitude for the drums. There wasn't a great deal of information available. It's not like today.
Yeah.
I used to go out illegally in the 60s to places where people like the aforementioned Terry Tuttle played,
yeah,
and places like that, and watch them and learn from them. And some were good and some were terrible. But as I'm sure you can imagine, and listeners or readers, I beg your pardon, can imagine, the drum kit is something you can learn by watching. And I've mentioned this before.
Yep.
You can learn by watching it. And so I watched them. There are a few books available that I could get my hands on.
Yeah.
What really got me, and we had to learn how to use our wrists on these drums too, because they were so slack. They were pigskin. This was before we had plastic skins.
Yeah.
And so you couldn't get them very tight, you know, so you really had to work to get bounce off the drum head.
Okay.
And some succeeded and some didn't, and I succeeded in doing that. We had one chap come along towards the end of our schooling who'd actually left school a few years before and joined a pipe band. And even though pipe band music is not my favourite, the drummers have superb technique. They have to have superb technique to play that music. And they also have very, very, very tight snare drums. So if you make a mistake, it really stands out, you know. And this bloke, Bobby, he used to come along and show us a few things.
Was he your first real drum teacher?
Well, he was the only drum teacher. I didn't take lessons. I never had any lessons, which I always thought it was rather cheeky of me to become a prominent teacher, as I did. But I taught myself and then I taught them, you know. That's how simple it was.
Yep. The thing I find fascinating about drummers is that you can play a beat on this hand, you can play a beat on this hand, and a different beat on this leg and on this leg. four different beats. Now, I find that almost miraculous. Now, did it come easy to you, having different beats on all those?
No. Independence. No? Independence is very, very difficult. And
is that what you call it, independence?
Yeah, it's just called independence, yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, it took a long time to get that going, especially when you were younger and you couldn't, you didn't see other blokes as much as would have come in handy.
Yeah.
Now you've got DVDs, you've got books, you've got everything, you know, and the standard of players today is quite remarkable. You know, it's
good or bad?
Oh, superb.
Absolutely. Really? So superb. You'd say drummers nowadays are probably better than drummers back in the 50s and 60s?
Yes, yes.
Because they can watch more stuff, yeah.
Musicality also comes into it. You know, people don't think in terms of musicality, but that comes into it as well. One of my specialties was backing vocalists, for instance, of which the aforementioned Christine Bailey isn't a bad example, by the way.
Yeah.
In order to do that, I had to learn how to play with the brushes. Now, I guess you've seen...
I have, yeah.
...brushwork. Brushes were very interesting. They came out of New Orleans, where they used to use fly swats. Yeah, it sounds so funny, doesn't it? They used to use bamboo fly swats because the drumsticks were too noisy, you know? And then eventually somebody came up with the idea of metal. And one of the things with drumming that has amused me over the years is the drum companies come up with an idea, and I don't buy the drum. There's a marvellous magazine called Modern Drummer, and I haven't bought that for many a year now, but I used to subscribe to it. Mm. And about once every 10 years, the drum manufacturers would come up with an idea.
Yeah.
And thus, those of us that were older would get a good laugh out of that, because 10 years previously, somebody had come up with that idea and the same thing. Yeah. So they'd changed a tiny little thing on it and, come up with a new,
new revolutionary
innovative movement for the drum corps.
Now, did you have, when you were, sorry to interrupt, but feel free to keep going if you wish. When you were in the cadets, did you have a kit at home to practice on?
No. Now, this is a very interesting thing.
So how did you practice?
I took books and put them on the bed. I had a thin book for the snare drum, which is the sharp, clingy one, you know.
I don't know. But
the one you hear most.
Okay.
It's the one you hear the backbeat in a rock and roll.
Yeah.
A medium thin book there in front of that.
Yeah.
And a thick book. I always... most of my life I played a four-piece kit.
Okay.
You know, a lot of blokes played with two tom-toms on the bass drum, or mounted around the bass drum.
Yeah.
And, at one stage of the game, the heavy metal blokes had about 10, you know, they were incredible. But I started out just playing, and just used the bedspread as a cymbal, you know, and I started out teaching myself how to play on these books.
Now, how often would you do that?
Every day.
Every day you practice?
Every day I practice,
From what age?
Oh, roughly from about 14 onwards, I suppose.
For how many years?
I was out working when I was about 17.
Mm.
But the pub had its own drum kit. I didn't have one. The pub had one.
The pub?
The pub actually had its own drum
kit. Sorry, what pub are you talking about?
Well, I don't know. It's now a row of shops, but it used to be called the Imperial.
Okay, yeah.
Funny days, because the drinking age was 21, and when the licensing squad blokes turned up, myself and the saxophone player would have to beat a hasty retreat to the toilets and wait until they'd gone, and then come back and start playing.
Well, because you weren't 21.
Because we weren't 21, yeah. And of course, you didn't get paid very much either. But it was all part of the learning process. And by the time I was 19, I'd amassed enough to buy myself a reasonable drum kit.
So you're saying from the age of 14 to 19, basically, you practiced at home most days on books?
Yeah, that's right.
That's extraordinary. That's 5 years of banging away on your bed.
Yeah.
On the books.
That's right.
Would you recommend it to anybody else? Is it a good way to learn?
No, not really. It could be most frustrating at times.
Why didn't your parents buy you a drum kit?
Oh, wasn't even considered.
Did you ask them?
Yeah, and they said no. It wasn't considered to be...
essential.
It wasn't considered to be a musical instrument, really, you know. What they did do, and for the first time that... they went into hock, was bought me a clarinet. And it was a very expensive clarinet too, because they didn't know any better. When the bloke in the shop got hold of me, must have thought it was Christmas. But I couldn't come to terms with it.
Why not?
I just couldn't manage it. I just couldn't manage it, Phil. I ended up swapping it for a cymbal. Nearly broke my father's heart. All that money they'd spent on the clarinet, and I bought this. I mean, the cymbals in those days were, and still are in the States, were measured in inches, and it was a pound sterling per inch. And I bought a 20-inch ride cymbal, you know, the one that you play on most of the time. And I've no idea how much the clarinet cost, but I think it was probably 60 or 70 pounds.
Ooh.
So, yeah, that was a fair old, yes. He was a good bloke, and he didn't go crook. He just sort of, his brow darkened, and he went off to read the paper or something.
Did they sort of support you throughout your career much, or they just tolerated it all? How would you describe their attitude to your music?
They just tolerated it. They came to see me play once when I was living in Melbourne.
Yeah.
Came with my brother and his fiancée at that time. That's the only time they ever saw me play.
Your brothers? Did they ever come and watch you?
No.
No?
Oh, Terry did once with Mum and Dad.
Yeah.
But no. Just weren't interested, you know. It's just something I did, something different.
So you got your first drum kit at 19, is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
And that was what, 1950 what?
Well, I was born in 49.
So 1968.
Yeah.
Were you born in 49 or 39?
49.
49, yeah. Sorry, mate. that's 29, yeah, that's 1968, isn't it?
Yeah.
Must be.
Yeah, that's about right.
Yep.
67, 68, that's about right, yeah. It was a good kit too. It was a Ludwig kit made by the American William F. Ludwig Company. An interesting story about that particular company was drum kit manufacturing was pretty competitive,
yeah.
And Ringo Starr had always played British-made drums, and his main ambition in life was to get an American kit. And finally, when the Beatles started to do a bit of good for themselves,
yeah,
there was the money, and so he bought a Ludwig kit. Then they started to appear on things like, you know, television shows and things like that. And suddenly the Ludwig Company was working 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, making drum kits.
Because Ringo played.
Everybody wanted a drum kit.
Is that why you bought a Ludwig?
Yes.
Yeah. Is that why you bought one?
No, I got a good price. There was a bloke in Hobart who was the agent, who was a friend of mine, and he got me a good price on it. And Dad did loan me some money.
Good.
You know, which I paid back from my, because I then went out and was just doing just little dance jobs, you know, in dance halls and things like that. Nothing of any great import. Playing rock and roll sometimes, very seldom, mainly playing swing music for ballroom dancing.
Now, before we get on to that essential question about why jazz and not rock and roll, do you remember, you're 19, you got your first kit, nice kit. Well, when was your first gig? And who did you play with?
Well.
Can you remember?
No.
Have a guess.
I really can't remember. This is where we're going to probably run into a few problems. I realise this. I really can't remember. I can't remember. In the 60s, I worked for a long time with a fellow called Lynn Thomas, who was a phenomenal guitar player, still around, and a bassist named Tim Partridge. And Tim was also a very, very, very fine player. And we did a lot of work together.
Yeah.
We played a little bit of jazz. If you were doing a gig, a dinner music gig, for instance, you'd play sort of jazz-based stuff while the dining was going on and then move into a softer rock sort of feel for the dancing.
Okay, yes.
The first important thing that I did, I was asked by Ian Pierce, who was my, and I dedicate this
oral history
to Ian, rest his soul. He was a tremendous influence on me, and he asked me to play at one of the jazz conventions. Every year they have a jazz convention at Boxing Day to New Year's Eve in different cities. And this particular one was in Hobart in the 60s. And his drummer, his brother Cedric, didn't turn up. And so Ian asked me if I'd play.
He must have seen you somewhere.
Well, yeah, must have done.
Yeah.
With great trepidation I did. And he said, you better be careful, there's a drum solo in this.
was it an honour to be asked to?
Oh, yes, indeed. It was Mr. Pierce.
Mr. Pierce, was
it? Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes, indeed.
And was Tom Pickering with him at the time?
Tom was there at the time. Yes, that's right. I can't remember who else.
Where was the gig?
Was in the band.
Sorry. Where was the gig?
At the Playhouse.
Okay.
Yeah. I did get an acetate of it, but it was so horrible I threw it away. It was not worth listening to. But from then on, Ian became very, very helpful to me.
Yeah.
And the phone call, when his brother Cedric couldn't play, Ian, you know, the phone would ring and Ian would ask me to go and play.
All right.
His regular drummer had become Mike Colrain, and Ian's gone now, but Mike played with him for many, many years, but there were nights when Mike couldn't do it, and so I got in.
Yeah.
Ian used to swear blind that he asked me to join the band and not didn't ask Mike, but I would have known. I think he got that wrong. But that's beside the point, really. I learnt just about all that I know about jazz from Ian, because he had this phenomenal record collection that sort of dated from about 1920 up until into the 90s, you know. So he'd be listening to this way out modern jazz 1 minute, and then he'd be listening to Louis Armstrong, from 1924, you know. And so I'd be listening along with him and learning, and he'd be pointing things out.
Yep.
Wonderful influence.
Yeah.
Just wonderful influence.
We'll talk about Ian a bit later on as well. I mean, I think he's obviously one of the most central characters to jazz. I suppose my question is very sort of, it comes from a basis of ignorance. The late 50s, early 60s was all about, you know, Elvis Presley, and in Australia it was Johnny O'Keefe. It was all rock and roll. So what happened with you? Why didn't you go down the rock and roll era?
Well,
and so why did you sort of move off towards jazz?
Because I wanted to play jazz, because it just, pardon the bad pun, struck a chord with me, and that was that. I played a hell of a lot of rock and roll.
Did you? In the early days?
Yes.
Or when?
All when I needed a quid, all a dollar, all through my playing days. Not later on. Later on, the younger players came along, and I was happy to let them go. But in the 60s, I played a lot of rock and roll. Yes.
Okay. What sort of songs?
Just basic hit parade songs.
A lot of
Beatles, that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
A lot of blues. We played a lot of with guys that were into playing blues songs.
Yeah.
But what I did do was that I studied the genres. You know, I really studied them. I didn't just pick up and start playing. Yeah. I studied what was, you know, how it was done, and so forth and so on, and not many of the blokes did that. They just they learned how to play the snare drum on 2 and 4 and bang the, you know, sort of bang 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 thump, and that was all that they did.
Yep.
Whereas I used to listen. I got most of my education through listening.
Okay.
And I still say that to this day, you know, you must listen before, you know.
But you did actually say that on, also you watch with drums.
Yeah.
You watch people
watching,
and you listen. Yeah.
Watching as well. But, you know, it was more listening. I don't have it anymore, but I had a tremendous record collection. It really was. I had, I don't know, must have been nearly 1,000 LPs.
1,000
that I'd bought over the years, you know.
You must spend a lot of time listening to music.
Well, you did, yeah. That was your education, really. When you weren't taking lessons, and I wasn't taking lessons, you know. And of course, as time went by, and things like videos came out and so forth, well, that was a whole new world for you too, you know.
Yep.
Obviously it was.
Now look, this is probably a good, we've been going an hour, which is a long time. Do you want a bit of a break? We'll have a drink and perhaps come back?
Yeah, let's just take a minute.
Okay.